Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, and the usual two interviews up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll speak with Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, about the Venezuelan economy, which suffered a recession, but is certainly not suffering the structural collapse that many of its enemies have hoped for. The decline in oil prices was supposed to bring about the final reckoning of the Venezuelan economy. Well, they had a recession, but so did everyone else, almost everyone else. And now oil prices are back up. So we will talk to Mark about, as they say, the structural and conjunctural conditions of the Venezuelan economy and what, for the over the longer term, the Chavez administration has done to improve the social indicators in that country. And they have done a lot. We'll get the details from Mark on that. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk to the labor journalist Steve Early, based in the Boston area, about the imminent retirement of Andy Stern as president of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. Stern got a lot of press in recent years as the great hope of the labor movement, the great hope for the labor movement's revival. Then over the last year or two, lots of bad press as scandal and internal dissension and civil wars with other unions besmirched the previously golden image of Andy Stern. And we'll talk with Steve Early about his career and what went on with SEIU and how he managed to leave a union with almost 2 million members, over $120 million in debt, a remarkable achievement. How did he do it? Where did the money go? All right, before all that, some words in the economic news. Our president gave a speech on Thursday in the Great Hall at Cooper Union, the site of Abraham Lincoln's rather conservative 1860 speech on slavery. Obama's speech was on a much less elevated topic, financial regulation. He made a lot of appealing sounds, and the financial execs in the front row mostly sat on their hands. But while he was talking, Congress was busy working out compromises, and Wall Street's army of lobbyists were at their sides. So I'm going to reserve commentary until we see what's actually in the final product. Will there be a consumer protection agency, or will that be sacrificed on the altar of bipartisanship? And how strict will the regulations on derivatives be, or will there be custom-crafted loopholes written into the legislation? My guess is that the consumer protection agency will at best be notional, and the loopholes will be wide enough to fit a truckload of custom derivatives through. Otherwise, the Republicans and moderate Dems wouldn't be going so quietly along with the negotiations. Perhaps I'm being too cynical. We'll see soon enough. One of the controversial bits in the prospective legislation is the idea of imposing a special tax on big banks to build up a fund to pay for the next bailout. This scheme has the endorsement of no less an orthodox authority than the IMF. This does seem like we're preparing for the routinization of disaster, when instead the emphasis should be on preventing disaster, but it never hurts to be prepared. But surprisingly, the government looks to be spending a lot less on the bailouts than was initially feared. GM has now paid back its government loans in full and early. And the Federal Reserve has just turned over almost $50 billion in profits from its 2009 operations to the U.S. Treasury. The Fed is a curious institution for a government body. It's entirely self-financing. It buys up government bonds using money it creates out of thin air and pockets the resulting interest payments. Banks who want currency get it from the Fed by turning over valuable interest-earning assets and getting pieces of paper that cost pennies to print in return. The Fed spends whatever it wants to on its own operations. It's never audited, and then it hands over what's left to the Treasury every spring. It never has to ask Congress for money, and its internal workings remain mostly opaque. Nice for them. In recent years, the Fed's annual profits have averaged around $25 billion. Last year, it made almost twice that, mainly by buying up mortgage-backed securities in the heat of the financial crisis at beaten-down prices when no one else wanted them. Now that things are recovering, the Fed was able to sell those securities at a profit. And it looks like the government is spending far less than was initially offered on capital injections to bolster the financial system. Only a bit over half of the announced amount has actually been spent, and if present trends continue, a lot of what has been spent will be recovered. That's the good news. The bad news is how little has changed. Wall Street is back to its old tricks. It's not outlandish to assume they're already cooking up the next crisis. I'm coming late to this, but such are the limitations of a weekly show. But how satisfying it is to see the SEC's complaint against Goldman Sachs. As everyone probably knows by now, the SEC is accusing Goldman of tricking clients into buying some crappy mortgage securities, ones that were hand-picked as likely to go under by another of its clients, hedge fund hotshot John Paulson. To bet against these securities, Paulson needed someone to take the other side of the trade. Basically, Goldman brokered a deal so that the buyer's almost certain losses would be the source of Paulson's almost certain gains. It all worked out for Paulson, or so the SEC says. But Goldman can afford the best lawyers in the world, among them a former top Obama advisor, and the SEC is staffed by civil servants, so it's quite likely that Goldman will get off lightly or better. Still, it's deeply satisfying to see this immensely rich and well-connected firm take a few hits. One wonders, though, why anyone would continue to do business with Goldman if this is how they allegedly treat their clients. It wasn't all that long ago that Goldman chair Lloyd Blankfein described his firm as doing God's work. I'm about as secular as they come, but I don't see that sort of thing in any God's job description that I know of. Moving on, Jonathan Martin and Ben Smith of Politico.com posted an article on Thursday saying, as Smith put it in his Facebook status update, enough already with the Tea Party. The media is obsessed with these nutters, even though their actual numbers are rather small. Martin and Smith even quote Cindy Sheehan as pointing out that the Tea Partiers are getting far more coverage than the anti-war movement ever got, even though that movement was able to turn out hundreds of thousands of people, 100 or more times as many as the Tea Party has been able to muster. Something similar with the demos in defense of immigrants' rights. A recent one in D.C. turned out many more times than a Tea Party action ever did, but it was mostly ignored. As a friend points out, a rally in Springfield, Illinois on Wednesday to protest likely budget cuts in education and social services turned out 15,000, about 15 times as many as a Tea Party a week earlier that got far more media attention. The TPers represent a fervent minority of Americans, a brand of hard-right anti-government sentiment that is as old as the hills, but is treated as an exciting new phenomenon. Politico.com often publishes some fairly debased political gossip and horse race-type speculation, but thanks to Martin and Smith for doing this. Let's hope the rest of the media follow suit. As a footnote, it's important to point out that liberals have done their fair share in puffing up the Tea Party. They love nothing more than getting hot and bothered over the fascist threat as a way of scaring people into voting for Democrats as our last line of defense against the brown shirts. Yeah, the Tea Partiers are awful, and a lot of people hate Obama for all the wrong reasons, starting with his skin color, but he's earned plenty of criticism for the way he serves money and empire so dutifully. Finally, a quick word about Oxfam America. I got an email the other day from Anuradha Mittal, the excellent director of the Oakland Institute, pointing to an open letter that her institute and several other groups wrote to Oxfam America, protesting Oxfam's stance in favor of genetically modified foods. I'm probably more sympathetic to bioengineering than Mittal, or probably many in the audience, but that's not what I want to talk about. I invited Oxfam to provide a representative to debate Mittal on this show. Oxfam declined in a very haughty and dismissive way, and sort of denied that they supported genetic engineering besides. Well, it turns out that they've got a grant application into the Gates Foundation to support their work on the application of biotech in Africa. I've seen the document, so I'm not relying on hearsay. So if you're going to take that position, why not have the nerve to defend it publicly instead of dissimulating? Huh, Oxfam? Okay, let's take a musical break.
Dreaming.
Got such good reactions to the songs from Wire I played last week that I thought I'd revisit them. Wire, Our Time, from the EP Read and Burn 03. Okay, we are now joined by Mark Weisbrot, who is an economist and the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Doug. Great to be here.
It's good to have you. It's been too long.
You know, can I ask you, is your show available on podcast or the web?
It certainly is. You can find the archive on leftbusinessobserver.com and also on iTunes.
That's great.
So the world will be hearing this shortly.
Thank you.
It's also on the WBAI and KPFA archives after it's broadcast as well, but in somewhat higher fidelity on that podcast that I mentioned. Okay, so you can I got an email from your people the other day containing an article that you did for Le Monde Diplomatique on Venezuela's economic policy, and I notice it's not up on your website yet, but I presume it will be shortly, CEPR.net. But let's start with, before we get into the sort of more cyclical questions, let's start with a look at the long sweep of the Chavez administration. They've been in power for quite a few years now, so they've had a chance to change things rather significantly in Venezuela. How has the economy done, and how have the social indicators changed over the decade or so?
Well, the first few years, they were just kind of fighting for survival. That was Chavez took office, was elected in 98 and took office in February of 99. But he didn't have control over the domestic oil industry. It was a nationalized company since 1976, but it was controlled by people who wanted to basically overthrow the government, and who did, in fact, temporarily do that in April of 2002 for a couple of days. And they didn't get control really until 2003, first quarter 2003. And then they did quite well for, you know, next 5.5 years, really, until the world recession hit. The economy nearly doubled in size. They cut poverty by half and extreme poverty by more than 70%, tripled social spending, and they created clinics and health care, got thanks to thousands of Cuban doctors. They provided health care to almost everybody, and who didn't have it before, too, most of them. Most of the poor people, I should say, didn't have it. And they also doubled the enrollment in higher education. So those were the main, I think, accomplishments during those years.
Now, as is the case with many oil-producing countries, despite the natural wealth that endowment should provide, Venezuela has historically had a pretty high level of poverty, right?
Yeah, they did. And as I said, it's I think about 27% now, the official poverty rate, and it was a little more than twice that when they got control of the oil industry. So that was a big thing. That's a huge thing. They really needed that to do anything.
How much have these good economic and social results been a byproduct of the rise in oil prices over much of that period?
I would say only part of it. I mean, first of all, you never saw anything like this in the past, and you've had equally large run-ups in real oil prices in the 70s, for example, and you didn't have anything like this before.
So what were the mechanisms by which they spread this wealth?
Well, mainly the social missions were a big thing. That's how they provided the health care. The expansion of education was, you know, just more schools. There's been some other social programs as well. I mean, they greatly increased spending on retirees, on Social Security. That's another huge increase. That was part of their increase in social spending. So those were the main, and food, I should say, also. They have a nationwide system of stores which subsidize food as well.
And then what about all these experiments I've heard about but don't know very much in detail about, the experiments with cooperatives and other forms of alternative ownership structures for to build a 21st century socialism, as Chavez calls it?
Well, I haven't really investigated that as much, to tell you the truth. I mean, obviously some of them are successful, some of them aren't. There are certainly, the government certainly provided funding for it, and there are definitely a lot more choices for workers that want to form cooperatives, for example.
So when oil prices collapsed, going from, what, about $140 to, what did it bottom out at, like 40?
40. 50?
Yeah, 40. So, you know, we took $100 off the oil price. What kind of impact did that have on Venezuela? I think a lot of Chavez's enemies were certainly cheering on his end, but that didn't work out quite that way. But what impact did it have on the country?
Well, more than it should have, really. I think they had a lot of reserves, and they could have. That was a very quick collapse. It was in 6 months, really, from the fourth quarter of 2008, first quarter of 2009. They could have just ignored it because they had large reserves. They could have pursued counter-cyclical policies in 2009, and they didn't. And I think that's why they had a recession. The economy fell about 3.3% in 2009. But the poverty rate hasn't increased, and unemployment is fairly steady. So they've managed to insulate a lot of people from that shock.
Do you have any idea why they didn't do more to try to spend their way out of trouble? Certainly a lot of the Asian countries did that rather successfully. As you point out in your piece in Le Monde Diplomatique, Bolivia even had an ambitious stimulus program. Why not Venezuela? They had the money.
Yeah, I don't know, to tell you the truth. I think it's just a kind of conservatism, you know, that you see in a lot of governments. Obviously the thing that you have to worry about in the situation is that you would run out of foreign exchange. They did have a lot of capital flight, and they still do. They have, you know, capital controls, but they're not all that effective. So probably they were worried that they would reach a level where they could end up with a balance of payments crisis. But, you know, I find that really unlikely that it could ever happen. I mean, they have enormous borrowing capacity as well, you know, if it ever came to that. And they don't have a very high foreign debt. So they should have done it.
On paper, their international books look a lot better than the United States.
Well, that doesn't say a lot.
No, it certainly doesn't. But they do have a bit of an inflation problem, don't they?
Yeah, that they do. They've got, in fact, I think it's now the highest inflation in the world, although it doesn't really mean that much by historical standards, because inflation is so low. But, yeah, it's running at about 26% year over year right now. It's averaged 20% annually for the last 7 years. Of course, that's much lower than the pre-Chavez era, but it's the problem is, you can live with inflation like that, and most of Latin America did back in the, 60s and 70s. And, of course, they did much better economically than they did in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. But it's not the inflation in itself, but the fact is that, you know, because everyone else's inflation is low and they have a fixed exchange rate, that's the real problem, is they have a fixed exchange rate. And so what happens is every year that they have inflation of 20% and their trading partners is, you know, a tiny fraction of that, currency becomes overvalued by quite a lot each year, and that's hurting them. And they really should do something about it. Now, in January, they did a devaluation, but from 2.15 to 4.3 to the dollar. It probably wasn't enough. It's probably still overvalued. And the fixed rate is just not a really good idea, in my opinion. They should have you know, most of the hemisphere has some kind of managed floating exchange rate, and I think that's a lot more viable.
I suspect a lot of listeners would find this a little arcane, so let's unpack this slightly. Why would a high inflation lead to pressures on the currency?
Well, you know, the exchange rate, so, you know, between two countries, there's what we call the nominal exchange rate, which just tells you, okay, you know, there's 4.3 bolivars for $1. That's the exchange rate in nominal terms, but just like any other variable like GDP or interest rates, it's also affected by inflation. And so when you look at that exchange rate, you over time, if there's inflation and you hold the nominal rate fixed, the real rate is what's changing. The relative prices in the two countries change. And so the exchange rate, if you have higher inflation than other people, than your trading partners, your exchange rate becomes, in real terms, more and more overvalued, and that's what matters for your trade. So your exports become less competitive, and you're basically subsidizing other people to import to your country. So you're hurting your manufacturing, agriculture, any kind of tradable goods. And that's what Venezuela's been doing the last few years.
And that also creates black market pressures for the—
Yeah, well, they have a parallel rate. It's about 7 to the dollar right now. That's the, you know, the black market. And that may be the majority of foreign exchange transactions taking place there. But anyway, just for, you know, to get away from the technicalities and the meaning of it, it really is it's something that really makes it difficult or impossible for the country to diversify away from oil.
Yeah, oil, of course, being priced in dollars, their exchange rate doesn't matter so much for that. But have they had any success in diversifying beyond oil?
Not that much, really. And again, I think it's attributable to the overvalued exchange rate.
What would they like to do other than oil?
Well, you have to ask them that. But I think they have, you know, they have plans for diversifying into, you know, manufacturing, light manufacturing. I mean, they have done some, you know, pilot projects. They're producing laptops there, for example, you know, some other projects, joint ventures with China. But if you look at the aggregate statistics, you know, manufacturing in the last couple of years is declining as a percent of GDP.
Which is probably the opposite of the direction they should be going in.
Yes. But, you know, they have 500 billion barrels of oil, and, you know, they're taking not even a billion out of the ground every year. So they're going to be okay.
So they got 5 centuries worth of oil, assuming the planet survives.
And, you know, that's, I mean, that's the latest estimate from the Geological Society in the U.S., but I think the people who think that there's some kind of disaster up ahead for Venezuela, that's really not likely. They can do a lot of experiments. Some of them are successful. I think, you know, for most of the last 7 years, the 5.5 years at least, they got most of the macro policy right, just not the exchange rate. But they'll have time to change that. And, you know, all these things you see in the business press, which is always portraying the country on the brink of collapse, never even reported any of the successful things, I think those are highly exaggerated.
Yeah, there's a story in the Financial Times about businesses fear that if they criticize Chavez, they're going to get expropriated.
Yeah, that's kind of ridiculous. I think that, you know, everything you read about Venezuela is in most of the media is so exaggerated. I mean, all you have to do is actually go there. I can always tell the people who haven't ever seen the place, you know, because, first of all, when they say Chavez is a dictator, I mean, if anybody who sets foot in that country would never use that word, because the first thing you see is the media is overwhelmingly against the government, like the vast majority of it, broadcasts, newspapers. It's like Fox News on steroids, half of it. And you don't have anything like it. I mean, it's not even permitted in the United States under FCC rules to do the kind of things the media does there. So, you know, the idea that this is a dictatorship is kind of absurd, but that is what, that's the impression that most people have.
Well, it's interesting you said earlier, too, that they don't really have any very strict capital controls. So for, you know, allegedly authoritarian socialist regime, that's a pretty loose ship they're running.
No, it's a very loose ship. If anything, it's more of an anarchistic state than an authoritarian one, but you would never get that impression from reading the press.
Still, Chavez's poll numbers are down, aren't they?
Yeah, and you would expect that from the, you know, recession of last year, and also because the media is so powerful. I mean, imagine that Obama was facing Fox on most of the networks and the New York Times, the Washington Post. Well, the Washington Post is almost Fox in some ways, but not in their news coverage of the administration.
With no Keith Olbermann doing cheerleading.
Yeah, well, they have that. I mean, they have state TV in Venezuela too, but it's a very small audience compared to the private.
And what are the prospects for the economy now that things seem to be stabilizing in the outside world, the U.S. in some sort of semblance of a recovery? Do you think things should be looking up soon for the Venezuelan economy?
I think they should pick up pretty soon, yeah. I mean, you know, the government, I think, realized they're going to have to stimulate the economy. They got an election coming up in the fall, so it's almost guaranteed that they'll be spending a lot more. And oil at $83 a barrel, they've got the money. It's just a question of being able to, you know, it's administrative capacity is the main thing. They got infrastructure they need. They had huge electricity shortages. That's hurt Chavez, you know, in the last year. Of course, you have them most of South America. But in Venezuela, again, because everything is magnified by the media, it's a lot worse.
Yeah, but why would, you know, a country with enormous oil reserves
like this
have electricity problems? Oh, it's a hydro problem.
Yeah, it's like 70% of their electricity is hydroelectric, and they got the same drought problems everybody else had.
Ah, it's a drought problem. So do they ever reflect on building a 21st century socialism on a 20th century hydrocarbon economy?
I don't know. I mean, they do have, I mean, you know, Chavez is a big kind of visionary thinker, and the government, you know, is always looking ahead at big projects, but they have... you know, they have the same problem that I think all the left governments in the region, which there are now quite a few, have, is the administrative capacity is very limited because, you know, most of the educated people who know how to run a government, for example, they're on the other side. A lot of them are in the government. You know, that's another thing that you wouldn't expect in an authoritarian state, but you have lots of people working for the government that are against it. And so it's very hard to carry out things.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, the oil company, I mean, all the technocrats there were quite hostile to the government and really ran things by their own lights for the first few years of Chavez's reign. Isn't that correct?
That's right. They used it. That's why you can't really hold him responsible for the first 4 years. Imagine if you had, like, the Federal Reserve in the U.S. trying to overthrow the government. It was the equivalent of that, you know. Yeah, they were just using it to literally try and topple the government, and they did. So you still have, you know, the United States is still pouring millions of dollars in there for things they won't disclose, but they acknowledge, USAID acknowledges putting in millions of dollars still.
Is there any change between Obama and Bush?
Oh, absolutely not on Latin America. No. Some people think he's worse, actually, because of the expansion of the, you know, U.S. military presence in Colombia, which greatly upset not only the left, the more left governments in South America, but also Chile and Brazil. They were all furious about it. You know, and the administration did everything they could to support the Honduran coup while saying they were against it. But if you followed it closely, they really did everything they could from day one, and I mean day one, when the White House announced, you know, the first statement came out of the White House when the government of Honduras was overthrown on June 28th was the only statement in the world that didn't condemn the coup. It just said, we hope that all parties can work together and resolve this problem. And that pretty much told you everything that was going to happen for the next 6 months. So, on Honduras, on Colombia, on Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, where, you know, the U.S. just cut off some money to Bolivia for climate change that they were providing because they don't like the position that the Evo, the government, is taking, and Morales is taking. And they don't have still an ambassador. They don't have ambassadors with Bolivia still. They still have trade sanctions against Bolivia. So it isn't just Venezuela. They're taking the same, at least as much hostility from this administration as there was from the Bush administration towards all of the left of center governments.
Well, as Sarah Palin put it, how's that hoopy changey thing working out for you? Not necessarily so well.
Not in Latin America.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Mark Weisbrot, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, and you can find them on the web at cepr.net. That's cepr.net. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Doug.
Let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about organized labor.
This is Phil Donahue. I have 600 channels in my home, but 400 of them are selling the Bowflex machine. That's why I listen to WBAI New York.
And this is WBAI, not only at 99.5 on your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And we will be fundraising soon, but in the interim, don't forget, if you visit that website, hit the donate button, and you will reduce the need for the imminent fundraiser, and we can shorten it and be more gracious about it, and that will make everyone happier. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, and let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear about Andy Stern. That was number 26 of the Goldberg Variations by Bach, performed by Ralph Kirkpatrick. That was, as you could tell, not Wire. But we'll hear more of that a little later. And Andy Stern, who has been the president of the Service Employees International Union for quite a while, recently announced that he will be retiring from that post very shortly. Stern was once one of the most highly praised leaders in the labor movement, tipped in the mainstream and left press as the great hope for the revival of a dormant organized labor movement. But the last couple of years have been a little more troubled for Stern. Lots of reports of fights within his union suppressing dissidents and also jurisdictional fights with other unions. And he also, several years ago, split off several unions from the AFL-CIO into a formation called Change to Win that was supposed to lead to a revival of union organizing and has led to nothing of the sort. So the great hopes of the Stern years now seem to be fading, and a successor will be taking the reins soon. The leading candidate is Anna Berger, who's been the Secretary of Treasury, but she may face some internal challenges. So, since the state of the labor movement is essential to any kind of revival of progressive politics in the U.S., it seems very important to evaluate what this all means. And so what better way to do that than to give a call to Steve Early, who is a veteran labor journalist who himself worked for the communications workers for many years. And now writes about the labor movement, and he had a piece about Stern, his reign on Counterpunch, and very much worth checking out. That's on counterpunch.org. Okay, Steve Early.
Only a few years ago, Andy Stern was a hot property, lionized in glowing profiles in both the left and the mainstream media as a great hope for reviving a dormant labor movement. Now he's leaving, somewhat with his tail between his legs. Were you surprised by his departure, or was this in the works for a while?
Well, there were rumors during the 2008 presidential campaign that if Obama won, Stern might be offered some position in the new administration. I don't think that was ever particularly realistic. I don't think he wanted to be Secretary of Labor, and I don't think he would have been nominated. But I think having played the role that he and SEIU played in helping the Obama administration enact health care legislation, he was attracted to the idea of going out on what SEIU proclaims to be that high note. I think he's actually setting a good example in some ways. It's absolutely right, as he said in his farewell message to the members, that too many labor leaders linger much too long. We don't have enough mandatory retirement age rules in the American labor movement, so people generally do not leave top positions like his at 60 or 62 or even 65. They hang on into their late 70s, and it creates a very calcified gerontocracy that's a big problem in a number of unions.
Stern didn't take a conventional path to the top of the labor movement. How did he get there?
Well, he actually is part of a larger generational cohort of union activists who first became more political during the civil rights, the anti-war movement, the women's movement in the 1960s. He went to the University of Pennsylvania, and after he graduated, he became a social worker. And the Social Workers Union in Pennsylvania at that time, State Employees Union, was an independent association. It became part of the Service Employees International Union. He became the local leader of a statewide affiliate of SEIU. And from there, eventually moved to the union's national headquarters, was its organizing director, and 15 years ago took over from John Sweeney as president of SEIU when Sweeney became the head of the AFL-CIO.
After years of being lionized, he's now gotten some bad reviews. What happened to him? Why this turn in the coverage on Andy?
Well, I think he began to lose some of his fervent following in the progressive community and in the press in 2004-2005 when he led the Change to Win charge out of the AFL-CIO. A lot of people were skeptical that this split was going to lead to much of anything, and many feared that it would weaken an already embattled and fairly weak labor movement. I think Change to Win has not lived up to its initial projections or promises. Several of the unions that founded it have now left and gone independent or returned to the AFL-CIO. It's not really functioning much better or differently than the AFL-CIO itself. More recently, Stern has been heavily involved in very costly and disruptive and dysfunctional conflicts with challengers within his own union, most significantly the West Coast-based National Union of Healthcare Workers, a breakaway rival healthcare union that was formed when he put the SEIU's third largest local into trusteeship in California a year ago. He's also picked a major fight with Unite Here, the combined garment and hotel workers union. A faction of that union has affiliated with SEIU, but the majority, mainly on the hotel workers' side, has been fighting off SEIU attacks on hotel worker jurisdictions. A lot of people see this as a pretty terrible organizational cannibalism, all coming at a time when there's tremendous external challenges to the very survival of unions in this country.
Getting involved in the Unite Here fight was pretty unusual, right? Most unions stayed out of the other's internal fights, didn't they?
Well, it was in complete contradiction to the professed principles, if you want to call them that, of Change to Win. When the seven unions that founded Change to Win broke away from the AFL, they emphasized the importance of unions sticking to their own knitting, sticking to their own jurisdictions, not wasting resources on jurisdictional conflict and competitive organizing. And here they are now, just 5 years later, turning on a fellow Change to Win union and claiming, as they have, that they have just as much right to go out and organize workers in hotels and food service companies and other workplaces where The hotel workers under John Wilhelm have been struggling for 20 or 30 years to rebuild a union that has also been widely recognized as one of the most organizing-oriented and progressive in the country.
Was there a strategy behind all these internal battles, or was it just aggrandizement and ego?
I think what has led to the tarnishing of Stern's legacy and these terrible inter- and intra-union battles really was this obsession with growth at any cost. Some of SEIU's membership gains over the last few years are impressive. They're the result of political deals in many states that have created new bargaining units, mainly for home-based workers, hundreds of thousands of low-wage women, primarily minority workers, foreign-born workers who provide home-based daycare and home health care aid services. It was a very important breakthrough to create an organizing model where they could be transformed from independent contractors to union members in new bargaining units. They're publicly funded, and so SEIU and other unions have been able to create new unions in that workforce and been able to negotiate some gains for them. But SEIU growth in its core jurisdictions and healthcare and building services and other industries where it's not possible to make that kind of political deal and where there continues to be intense employer resistance to unionization. So it only gained about 50,000 members last year, much slower growth than in previous years, and it's definitely encountering more and more resistance, even pursuing the organizing strategies that have worked for it in the past.
Yeah, I don't want to disparage the advantages of organizing home health care workers, but they're organized in very different ways from more conventional workers. The common thing is to give politicians large campaign donations and cut a deal with them when the campaign is over, whereas organizing private sector workers is a lot more challenging and you face a lot more hostility. Is that a fair comparison to draw?
It is, but I think the main challenge in the home-based workforce is how do you build a real union after you've gotten recognition, bargaining rights, an initial contract. These folks, many of them still on workfare in a number of states, are at a kind of bottom tier of the public sector. The better off union represented public employees are under attack. They're at risk of losing their pay and benefits. And a number of these programs that have been created to provide home health services and home-based daycare are also at risk of being cut. And unless you have an effective union organization, unless you have a mobilized membership, unless you have a kind of post-union recognition strategy, these are going to be rather hollow victories. And we can already see in California and other states a loss of membership, new membership in this sector. And you know, you have to build a an organization that is more community-based because people are not in a traditional workplace. They don't see co-workers. They don't have shop stewards. And I'm not sure that all the unions that are involved in this field are really willing to commit the kind of resources that are needed to build long-term organization.
An internal organization act involving the membership has not been the SEIU's long suit, has it?
No, I think it's always risky to generalize about an organization with 1.8 million members and 250-odd locals. But the trend in the union really has been away from functioning like a traditional workers' organization. I mean, the structure has become more like that of a kind of permanent political campaign, a D.C.-based advocacy organization like the Sierra Club or the AARP, where the members pay their dues, they're asked to make phone calls and do lobbying and sometimes show up for kind of staff-run mobilizations, but the union really doesn't function the way we think of unions functioning in the workplace. And I think that's a real weakness of the SEIU model, but it's symbolized by this shift towards what they call center servicing. Rather than people having shop stewards and access to a union representative on the job, they're given an 800 number and told to call a member resource center, where they deal with somebody like you would at the phone company or an airline or an insurance company.
Adolf Reed says Stern's vision of the labor movement is as of one giant human resource department.
It's a fair characterization. Again, there are locals that still do emphasize rank-and-file engagement and participation, that do train stop shop stewards that do try to develop rank-and-file leaders. But overall, the trend of the organization under Stern, and I think likely under his possible successors, will still be very much in the wrong direction. And it creates the impression of having more clout, influence, power than you actually have. But in fact, the organization becomes increasingly weak at the base if it ceases to function as an organization of workers with a presence on the job.
I'm speaking to Steve Early, the labor journalist. In the pursuit of that growth strategy, the core of Stern's philosophy has been that labor will gain power by increasing density, and at some magic point, everything will change when you reach a certain level of density. But to pursue that growth in membership, they made a lot of what have been called sweetheart deals with employers. Do you accept that evaluation? Did you talk some about that?
Well, there's definitely been a debate, and there should be a debate, about what are the appropriate trade-offs or quid pro quos between union growth based on organizing rights deals with particular employers and contract standards, where SEIU has gone too far. A number of its internal and external critics believe is by agreeing up front before a single worker is organized on contract terms, and then in return, the employer, it might be a nursing home, a hospital chain, a food service company, grants limited access to certain workplaces, agrees not to campaign against the union. And so the union gains members, some members, but they really have no voice in the negotiation of their first contract. There's often restrictions on their ability to strike or engage in workplace mobilization activity that might enable them to strengthen their contract in subsequent rounds of bargaining. And then there's the 800 number to call if you have a workplace problem or grievance. So this model has become increasingly controversial. And it's been challenged both by the National Union of Healthcare Workers and also by Unite Here. John Wilhelm has become a very articulate and forceful critic of this counterproductive approach to membership growth.
Under Stern, SEIU has also gotten deeply involved in politics, writing big checks, working on behalf of Democrats. Certainly, a lot of other unions have done that, but it seems like he did it with more intensity and with more resources. What have they gotten for this investment of money and people?
Well, again, the SEIU version is we have universal health care in the form of the legislation that the Obama administration was able to finally get through Congress at the end of March. Critics of SEIU would say that the union settled short, that it could have done much more to push for health care reform on a social insurance model. The Obama plan doesn't even include a public option. Single payer was ruled off the table with the assistance of SEIU in that regard very early on in the legislative process. And we paid a high price for passage of Obamacare in the form of losing the Senate supermajority that theoretically was there for 4 or 5 months and available also to enact labor law reform, the Employee Free Choice Act, which now appears to be a dead letter.
Well, it doesn't look like Obama pushed very hard for EFCA in the first place.
Well, the key problem during his first year in office was that he strung the union leadership along, and SEIU went along with this, told them that they had to enact support his efforts to enact health care reform, and labor law reform would be next. By the time they got the health care bill passed, they had lost the support in the Senate that they previously had for at least introducing labor law reform in some watered-down form. Today, it's not even discussed as a priority of the administration at all. So, and this is a terrible setback for the prospects of expanded union organizing in the private sector. It's the third time in 35 years that Democrats have taken the White House and Congress, promised to strengthen the National Labor Relations Act, and then failed to deliver.
And oddly enough, for a union of 1.8 million members that had been until at least recently growing rapidly, Stern leaves behind, something like $120 million in debt. How did they get so deeply into debt?
Well, they definitely spent heavily and proudly to help elect Obama and large Democratic majorities in 2008. Some of the borrowing was necessary to finance that political spending. But the union clearly is overextended, and the members are going to pay a high price for Stern's, I would say, legacy of financial mismanagement. The dues in SEIU are fairly high, about 2% of people's pay, And there's increasing membership dissatisfaction in many parts of the country about what people get for that, notwithstanding the good things the union has done and the political achievements that it can proudly boast of.
And how costly are all the battles against the dissidents in his own union and in other unions?
Well, they've been enormously costly. I mean, I try to do some calculations, and if you add up the money that was spent on all sides in their intervention in the Unite Here divorce, the trusteeship over United Healthcare Workers West that led to the creation of this new healthcare workers union, battles with several other unions like the Puerto Rican teachers, about $100 million has been spent on this over the last 3 years. That's almost as much or more as SEIU spent in 2008 and 2009 electing Obama and then trying to hold the Democrats accountable.
And it looks like his anointed successor is Anna Berger. Is that going to happen?
Well, you know, the College of Cardinals has yet to meet, and that literally is what we're dealing with here. It's the decision of who's going to succeed him is in the hands of a group of about 75 top officials. It appears there's going to be a contested race in that small electorate. Anna Berger is the secretary-treasurer. When Stern officially resigns, which he still hasn't done, she gets to replace him on a temporary basis, and then the union's International Executive Board chooses a successor until the next convention, which is 2 years off. Berger is being challenged by Mary Kay Henry, who's an executive vice president. And there's also some speculation that Dennis Rivera, the head of the union's healthcare division, a longtime leader of its 1199 affiliate in New York, may also throw his hat in the race.
Now, I get this straight that the members don't vote on the president?
The members definitely don't vote even at the beginning of any presidential term. It's a convention election. Stern and his leadership team were elected most recently in a convention in Puerto Rico in 2008 when there's a midterm vacancy like this. It's first filled on an interim basis. The secretary-treasurer moves up, and then the executive board elect somebody to fill out the remainder of the term. But it's 75 people, many of whom owe their jobs to Andy Stern or Anna Berger, and who don't even represent in an elected position any members in any local. They work in the headquarters and other parts of the bureaucracy.
Okay, now it's time for the concluding thumb-sucking. What is the heritage of Andy Stern, and is the labor movement better off for his moments of stardom?
Well, I think the lesson of Andy's reign, particularly the increasingly dysfunctional and destructive last few years of it, is that democracy still matters. He was always extremely disdainful of the idea that union democracy was at all important, and a much higher priority had to be put on union growth. I don't think you can rebuild the labor movement if your existing membership base feels it has no effective voice in their local or national union, if it's dissatisfied, if it's unhappy, if it's rebelling against the leadership. So I think we need to look again at the importance of having union structures that are democratic, leaders who are responsive to the rank and file, financial accountability, and a very different atmosphere than has developed politically within SEIU in the last few years.
And it looks like the deal-making approach to building numbers can build numbers, but it doesn't necessarily build strength. What's a better way to go about organizing and turning around the rather dismal fortunes of organized labor right now?
Well, I think it needs to be, particularly with the hard targets, a two-pronged strategy, and the better SEIU locals have pursued organizing on that basis, certainly UHW did before it was put under trusteeship, leverage campaigns would put pressure on major corporations, while at the same time the union is building committees of workers in the workplace, so you have an inside and outside strategy, then the organizing is more real. It's not just about wringing concessions through corporate campaign activity that's disconnected from building power through worker self-activity on the job.
And then finally, a question about the broader state of the labor movement now. They've put a lot of effort into electing a Democratic Congress, a Democratic president, and they don't seem to have gotten all that much for it. Is there much reflection going on with unorganized labor about how they insert themselves into politics, or are they just going to continue to
write checks? Well, I think there's a certain amount of self-censorship going on because of the fear that rank-and-file dissatisfaction, blue-collar voter alienation, a stay-at-home voter trend this fall might lead to the kind of defeats that the Democrats suffered in the House and the Senate in 1994 due to similar disillusion with the first 2 years of Bill Clinton. Certainly it's a mixed bag. The Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor under Obama has increased enforcement of the Occupational Health and Safety Act. It's hiring more people to go out and enforce wage and hour laws. As we mentioned earlier, the National Labor Relations Board is still not functioning very well. There's no hope at the moment for strengthening the law that it's supposed to enforce. And Obama has yet to move quickly to change the rules for organizing in the airline industry, for the Transportation Safety Administration staff people who've been waiting for years for the right to vote for a union in that part of the federal government. There's a lot of things that were promised that have not yet been done in terms of enabling workers to organize and bargain more effectively.
We've been listening to the labor journalist Steve Early. His article on Andy Stern's tenure as president of the Service Employees International Union is on the Counterpunch website, counterpunch.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with another one from Wire, this 1-2-XU. Till next week. Bye.
1-2-XU!